Senhoras e senhores deputados, muito bom dia. Vamos dar início à nossa reunião. Ela irá decorrer, óbvio, como não poderia deixar de ser, na Assembleia da República em português. E, portanto, permitir-me-ão, só breves instantes, que me dirijo aos nossos convidados em inglês, até porque me permite exercitar o inglês, que é coisa que já há bastante tempo não faço, mas será mesmo muito breve. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your interest in meeting with us to present the conclusions of your recent report and to exchange views with us. Our meeting is scheduled to last about 1 hour, and I'll give you the floor immediately, and then I'll hand it over to the Honourable MPs to ask their questions. Senhoras e senhores deputados, cumpre-me apresentar a delegação, que é presidida pelo Sr. Jean-François Dauphin, Sra. Goar Minasian. I don't know if you spell it this way, and Mr. Ipei Shibata. Okay. Portanto, como acabei de referir, vou dar a palavra ao Sr. Jean-François Dauphin, renovando os meus cumprimentos.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you so much for taking the time to meet with us. We really appreciate the opportunity. Maybe by way of background, I think in the past few years at the IMF, we've tried to engage more and more with parliamentarians, because it's a good, I think, practice for us to hear maybe a broader views of economic issues and economic policies from, you know, the broader political spectrum than the governments we typically engage with in all of our member countries. And it's also a good opportunity for us to present our own thinking and get feedback from you. So we've been doing this more and more in other countries as well, and we really appreciate the welcome receptions that we got here when we offered to present our report. So let me see. Oops, sorry. So just, I don't know how much you all are familiar with the IMF operations. I know the IMF, you know, about 10 years ago had maybe more of a presence here in Portugal, but you know, since the program time, we've reverted in Portugal with normal operations that we do with all of our member countries, which is that when you're a member of the IMF, you commit to have an annual kind of health check of your economy, right? So it's a bit like going to see you know, your GP and doing your blood test. So we have discussions with all of our member countries where we discuss economic policies, and the primary angle that we look at is, are the economic policies conducive to macroeconomic stability? That's basically our mandate. So we do that annually, and in the case of Portugal, we were here in June for an extensive visit, and then we prepared a report that was just discussed last week by our executive board and will be published this afternoon at 2 p.m. on our website. So we thought it was a very good time to come and give you a preview of the reports before it's actually out for publication. So I'll start with the bottom line and give you the key messages, and then I'll go into more details into some of these aspects. And I think the first thing that is really striking in Portugal is how remarkable the recovery has been from not only the COVID, but all the other shocks that followed COVID, you know, including the supply chain constraints, the energy disruptions, commodity prices shocks, and then the global inflation shocks. Growth in Portugal has exceeded the euro area average. Inflation has decelerated fast. So it's a pretty good picture, and in addition, do you need me to stop to make sure you have the translation? Okay. Okay. And one of the things that was particularly impressive was the fiscal outcome, and including the very, very impressive debt reduction, as we will see in a moment. So, you know, we see the outlook pretty benign in the short term. The problem is more long-term issues, subdued productivity growth, population aging, low investments. All of these are not necessarily specific to Portugal. A lot of countries in Europe in particular face similar issues. But in Portugal, you know, they're there, and they hamper higher growth and better living standards. So in terms of policies, what does that mean? I think, you know, we will discuss the fiscal policy in more details, because, you know, this is the Finance Commission, so we will be focusing mostly on this. So let me get back to that in a moment. On other policies, I think what we see is that financial stability indicators have improved and financial systemic risks have declined, but we do see a case to watch closely what's happening in the real estate sector, and be ready to adjust macroprudential policies accordingly. We, you know, to address the broader point on the lack of productivity, we do see the case for really continuing to implement reforms in the product markets, in the labor markets, that will help raise productivities. So these are the broad messages. Let me, if you don't mind, getting a little bit into more details. And as I said, I will particularly focus on fiscal issues. So we have a few graphs here. You know, you know them, the data as well as we do. The top left chart, I don't know if you can really read it, it's a bit small from here, but that chart shows you compares the growth in Europe and in the euro area and the growth in Portugal, and the key message is how faster the recovery was here as opposed to the average of euro area. The right-hand side top chart shows you how quickly inflation has decelerated. The bottom left chart is, to me, really one of the most striking. So the red bars are the fiscal deficits, the structural fiscal deficits in Europe, and the blue bars are the structural balance in Portugal. And look at how strikingly the difference is, right? When the euro area as a whole is still struggling with significant structural deficit, Portugal has managed to maintain actually structural primary positive balances, surpluses, even during the COVID period, and increasing those surpluses. And that has helped reduce public debt tremendously. The 35 percentage point of GDP of public debt reduction since COVID is really unique, extremely impressive. And when we had our discussion with the IMF Executive Board last week, one of the director, you know, said this is a model for the rest of Europe. I see some colleagues here taking picture. We're very happy to circulate the presentation after that, if that's okay with you. It's with this picture, you know, we do see that a soft landing is within reach, which means that, you know, growth is likely in 24 to be a bit slower than last year, but could rebound a little bit next year. But basically, the point is it remains fairly robust, and inflation is nicely coming down toward 2%, you know, the target, and is likely to hover around this target. So a fairly benign outlook. And we see risks around this central projection as pretty balanced. Among the risks that could worsen the outlook, of course, you know, escalating geopolitical tensions could lead to lower growth and higher inflation, in particular if they are accompanied with a commodity price shock. We do see that having a minority government is something that increases policy uncertainty and therefore may be detrimental to investment, also to the ability to carry the necessary reform or do that in a timely manner. And we're also watching closely what's happening with wage developments to make sure that, you know, wage don't durably outpace the real wage growth, do not durably outpace productivity growth, which would then could lead to some loss in competitiveness and some more stickiness in core inflation. On the other hand, we have positive risks also. In particular, we could see a more rapid easing of financial conditions that would, of course, boost consumption and investments. So, moving on to fiscal policy, you know, what should fiscal policy do at this stage? So, the way we think about it are a bit like short-term, long-term objectives for fiscal policies. Right? In the short term, that's kind of the right-hand side. We need to make sure we achieve this soft landing. So we need, on the one hand, to continue, you know, providing enough support to growth. On the other hand, we need to make sure fiscal policy does not run against the disinflation process that we are seeing. So it's a balancing act between growth and inflations, with a starting point, which is that in 2023, there were massive fiscal contraction that has helped support a faster disinflation, and the effect of which is still feeding through the economy. At the same time, as we are trying to balance growth and inflation, we still need to reduce public debt. The reduction in public debt was impressive, as I said, but if you zoom the chart that I showed earlier, I don't know if there's a pointer. No. And so the left-hand side chart, you know, the red bar is the red line is Portugal, the Portugal debt. The rest is the range of the European Union, the 25-75 percentile. And you see that even though the public debt in Portugal went down, it's still relatively high. And high debt means lower buffers in case of new shocks. It means also more vulnerabilities to change in market sentiment. So three objectives at the same time: growth, inflation, reduction in debt. When we put all of that together, so first of all, looking at what we call the fiscal stance, right? How much will fiscal policy contribute to either boosting the economy or contracting the economies? What we measure, you know, our understanding at this stage is that for this year, 2024, and next year, and actually beyond that, the targets of the government are small fiscal surpluses. And in terms of fiscal stance, that would mean, in our estimates, a slightly expansionary stance in 24, and then neutral fiscal stance after that. And we do think that this is appropriate. It's appropriate because the expansionary fiscal stance will help support the economy when we still have a monetary policy that is very tight, even though it's started to loosen, it's still very tight. And because the stance was so contractionary in 23, it will not run against the disinflation process. And at the same time, it helps reduce further debts because we still have quite large primary surpluses. And having neutral fiscal stances thereafter will you know, continue helping achieve macro stability in the sense of inflation and reduce debts. Now, you know, in terms of what that means concretely, as you know, the authorities designed the specific policy measures for the 25 budget, I think the message is that measures will need to be calibrated very carefully to make sure we do achieve a small fiscal surplus next year. And in addition, one thing that is important is to make sure that the measures that are taken, which may have a permanent impact, whether it's tax reductions or some spending increases, if these measures have permanent impact, we need to make sure they are met with measures, offsetting measures, that also will last in the long term. Because right now we're in a fairly comfortable situation because we have cyclical tax revenue that are very high, in particular from the banking sectors, with the significant profits that the banks have made in recent years with the increase in lending rates. But this is cyclical. This is not to last forever. So that's one of the key messages that we have here. Now, the other message or the other thing we're looking at is not only the fiscal stance, but also the composition of fiscal policy. And here, you know, the question we're asking ourselves is, how can we make the composition of fiscal policy as growth-friendly as possible? And one of the things, you know, first, if we look at the spending side, one of the things that we're seeing is that it would be very helpful to increase public investment. Public investment, and that's the graph that you have on the right-hand side. The red bar is, so this graph shows public investment in percent of GDP in euro area countries, and the red bar is Portugal. The line is the average. The two lines are average for the EU and average for the euro area. And as you can see, Portugal is amongst the countries where public investment is on the lower end. So that's a message. And at the same time, we know that we still have pressure on the fiscal that will come from aging, notwithstanding the important reforms that were taken in recent years. We have pressure from aging. So we're in this situation where we're trying to maintain small surpluses. We want to create space for more investments, and we know there's pressure for aging. So how do we square all of that, and how do we make space for more public investments? One thing is to try to increase the efficiency of spending. So get the best value that one can from the euros that are spent from public money. The other one, and that takes us to the tax side, the revenue side, the other important thing is that in Portugal, what we call, you know, in the technical jargon, tax expenditure, so all the losses, the revenue that is not not perceived because of the various tax exemptions, tax incentives, deductions, credits, and the like, are in Portugal fairly high, about estimated to be about 6% of GDP, which is about 2 percentage points of GDP higher than the euro area. And not only they're high, but they've been increasing in recent years. So we really encourage the authorities to look at those tax expenditures, and we know that actually there's a new tax unit that has been formed to that effect, so we're really looking forward to their analysis to see, you know, assess the costs and benefits of these. This is not a sign that I speak for too long, right? Okay. So, okay, now they're coming for me. So these tax expenditure, you know, one really needs to assess the cost benefits and see to what extent they're still needed and whether we can get more revenue by streamlining them. In terms of specific taxes, so first of all, in terms of personal income tax, what we see is that the revenue from personal income tax in Portugal, and that's the bottom left chart, are lower in Portugal than in most other countries and the average of the euro area. So when you see that they're lower, and at the same time, we need to increase investment, we don't really see a case to lower the personal income tax. And yet, in addition, we have some reservations about personal income tax that would be based on criteria such as nationality or residency or age, as opposed to income. On the corporate income tax, so here the story is a bit different. You see that Portugal, in terms of the revenues that are collected, is about the average of the euro area, but the statutory rates are actually higher. And here what we see is that the system is fairly complex in Portugal, and in particular it includes surcharges. So the rates are different by the how big the company is or how big the profits here are, and that is actually creates an incentive not to grow for companies. And so that creates a disincentive to growth, which is not helpful when we're trying to achieve higher growth. So that are the main messages that I wanted to convey on fiscal policies. Financial sector policy, I'm not going to go into details unless, if you have questions, I'm happy to go there. I think housing affordability is really a key concern. I mean, it's part of it is related also to the financial sector. Part of it is just a societal issue that Portugal is facing. Just a word on that point, that we, in our analysis, we see the key problem being on the supply side. There's just not enough building housing being built. And here it seems that the one of the key bottlenecks are excessive regulations and bureaucracies. So we would really encourage efforts in this area on streamlining the red tape. And let me skip the product and labor market reform so we can have time for a discussion on fiscal issues. But also, as I said, if you have questions, I'm happy to go into those issues as well. Thank you very much, and I look forward to your comments, feedback, and questions.
Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Jean-François Dauphin. I will now give the floor to the different parliamentary groups in order from the greatest to the smallest. So, I will begin by the parliamentary group that supports the government, the PSD. It will be Mr. Albert Fonseca to do the asking. Albert. Okay. Just a few moments. De qualquer modo, enquanto aguardamos pelo Sr. Deputado Alberto Fonseca, vou apresentando os senhores deputados que irão colocar as questões. Portanto, começará o Sr. Deputado Alberto Fonseca, em representação do Grupo Parlamentar do PSD. Seguir-se-á o Sr. Deputado Carlos Pereira, em representação do Grupo Parlamentar do Partido Socialista, que é, como sabem, o maior grupo parlamentar da oposição. E depois o Sr. Deputado Rui Afonso, em representação do Grupo Parlamentar do Partido Chega. Aí o Sr. Deputado... desculpa. O Sr. Deputado mudou de posição e o Sr. Deputado Paulo Núncio, do Grupo Parlamentar do CDS-PP, que, à semelhança do Grupo Parlamentar do PSD, suporta o Governo em coligação. A cada senhor deputado eu irei dar a palavra até 3 minutos, penso que será 3. Portanto, e depois de formuladas todas as questões, eu devolverei a palavra ao Sr. João Fonseca Dauphin para responder em conjunto às questões colocadas. Sr. Deputado Alberto Fonseca, faça favor.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Presidente. Agradeço aqui o compasso de espera só para organizar as ideias para não estar a perder tempo na intervenção. Cumprimento os senhores deputados e cumprimento o Sr. Jean-François Dauphin, Mrs. Goar Minassian, Ipe Chibata. Hello, good morning. Eu gostaria de fazer só aqui alguns comentários relativamente à apresentação que nos fizeram, e antes de mais agradeço também aqui a disponibilidade para nos vir aqui apresentar em primeira mão. Globalmente, a intervenção que fizeram e as recomendações que fizeram acompanham aquilo que é a posição do atual governo, portanto, daquilo que são as reformas que entendemos serem necessárias para fazer, com aqui, diria, apenas uma exceção, e já lá vamos, mas globalmente acompanham. Eu gostaria de começar aqui por colocar uma questão, se entendi bem, portanto, e isto está perfeitamente em linha com aquilo que é a minha posição pessoal. Eu julgo que disseram, portanto, que uma redução da dívida, diria demasiado rápida, poderá prejudicar o maior crescimento e as condições de vida. Este é aquilo que eu entendo, portanto, entendo que é extremamente necessário a redução da dívida. A nossa dívida pública é bastante elevada e nós temos efetivamente a necessidade de a reduzir, mas também, perdão a minha expressão, não deveremos entrar em loucuras e descê-la abruptamente, porque isso também poderá colocar em causa o crescimento da economia e a qualidade da vida. Portanto, isto dito por mim pessoalmente, que apenas a mim me vincula, tem um impacto, dito pelo FMI, tem outro. Portanto, gostaria apenas de confirmar se foi efetivamente isso que, aquilo que nos transmitiram. Um segundo ponto tem a ver indiretamente também com isto, que foi uma das principais mensagens que nos deixaram, que tem a ver com o facto de, para otimizarmos o nosso crescimento público, seria muito útil o aumento do investimento público, que está em linha com aquilo que nós pensamos neste momento, está em linha com aquilo que nós fomos dizendo ao longo dos últimos 8 anos, em que nós assistimos na governação do Partido Socialista com níveis de investimento público dos mais baixos da nossa história, e entendíamos à altura e agora que isso prejudicou o nosso crescimento. Portanto, gostaria também de sublinhar essa questão. E como o tempo está a chegar ao fim, avançava para uma terceira que é incontornável, que é, falou aqui bem, portanto, do facto de termos um governo que não é maioritário, portanto, não tem uma estabilidade para os investidores, portanto, que alicie os investidores a investir em Portugal. E por estes dias, aquilo que se fala em Portugal é da possibilidade de o Orçamento de Estado, que será apresentado nos próximos dias, poder vir a não ser aprovado. Isso poderá, no nosso entender, comprometer, entre muitas outras coisas, portanto, a execução do PRR, o tal investimento público que acabámos de falar, e o próprio crescimento da economia. Por isso, e para terminar, Sr. Presidente, que perguntava também aqui qual é o vosso entendimento de que impacto teria no potencial crescimento do nosso país este eventual chumbo do Orçamento de Estado. Muito obrigado.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Deputado Alberto Fonseca. A palavra agora é ao Sr. Deputado Carlos Pereira. Faça favor.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Presidente. Cumprimento a comitiva e gostaria de fazer algumas perguntas e pedir alguns comentários. Em primeiro lugar, agradecer de facto a apresentação e de alguma maneira também ter sublinhado aquilo que temos insistido aqui em Portugal, que temos insistido em Portugal, que tem a ver com a consistência do crescimento económico. Ficou muito claro na sua apresentação e, sobretudo, a recuperação extraordinária que Portugal fez depois da pandemia. Também a consistência da redução da dívida, da trajetória de redução da dívida. Infelizmente, nos últimos tempos, em Portugal, tem surgido uma contestação sobre uma eventual redução artificial da dívida. Foi bom ter apresentado de forma muito clara esta matéria, porque para nós é muito relevante este aspecto. E gostaria de fazer um comentário mais pormenorizado e gostaria de ter a sua opinião mais detalhada sobre algo que foi apresentado já pelo FMI, não nesta apresentação, mas numa nota preliminar em junho, em que o FMI comentou uma proposta apresentada pelo Governo para reduzir o imposto sobre o rendimento dos jovens, dizendo que implicava uma perda acentuada de receita e dizendo também que tinha uma eficácia incerta naquilo que era o objetivo principal, que é a migração dos jovens. Ao mesmo tempo, e mais recentemente, o Conselho de Finanças Públicas português divulgou números em que demonstrava que a implementação deste regime poderia levar Portugal a uma situação de passar de excedente para déficit já em 2026. Além do impacto orçamental, sublinhou também dúvidas sobre a eficácia deste regime. De resto, não conhecemos na Europa nenhum regime desta natureza, não há nenhuma demonstração de que isto funcione de facto. Aliás, o líder parlamentar do governo, do partido que suporta o governo, veio dizer mesmo que isto era uma experiência. E gostaria que comentasse esta matéria, que aliás foi alvo de intervenção também do FMI. Gostaria também de fazer uma outra questão que tem a ver de facto com o imposto sobre as empresas. É verdade que o imposto sobre as empresas aparece acima da média, mas a verdade é que a taxa efetiva de imposto sobre as empresas está sujeita a variadas isenções, muitas isenções, o que torna, de facto, bastante mais baixa. E, portanto, não é verdadeiro, efetivamente verdadeiro, dizer que a taxa, a maior parte das empresas em Portugal paga verdadeiramente uma taxa bastante abaixo da taxa estatutária.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Deputado Carlos Pereira. Vou passar agora a palavra ao Sr. Deputado Rui Afonso. Sr. Deputado, faça favor.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Presidente. Cumprimento as senhoras e senhores deputados. Quero cumprimentar também o Sr. Chefe da Missão do FMI para Portugal, Jean-François Dauphin, e a restante delegação. Bom, e desde já também agradecer realmente a apresentação à Comissão de Orçamento de Finanças e Administração Pública das conclusões do último relatório do artigo 4º a Portugal. Bom, a minha primeira questão vai exatamente para a dívida pública portuguesa. Conforme foi referido, a dívida pública portuguesa reduziu para 97,9% do PIB, apesar de em termos, digamos, absolutos, ter aumentado 9 mil milhões de euros. Eu não sei se eventualmente o FMI saberá como é que foi reduzida a dívida pública em Portugal. Se os senhores têm consciência que a dívida pública foi reduzida abaixo dos 100%, utilizando o chamado Fundo de Estabilização Financeira da Segurança Social e o Fundo da Caixa Geral de Aposentações, ou seja, o valor da dívida pública foi reduzindo utilizando o dinheiro destinado às pensões futuras dos portugueses. Eu não sei se os senhores têm noção dessa realidade. A segunda questão que lhe tenho para colocar tem a ver com o crescimento económico. Portugal recebeu, até ao momento, à volta de 160 mil milhões de euros em fundos comunitários. Contudo, e excetuando o ano de 2022, em que realmente houve um crescimento económico anormal, cerca de 6,7%, devido essencialmente ao cenário inflacionista que se viveu, Portugal manteve sempre cenários de crescimento económico pífios. E eu queria questionar o FMI sobre como é que nós podemos alavancar o crescimento económico português. Portugal tem estado sempre, enfim, na cauda da Europa relativamente a questões de investimento e atração de investimento estrangeiro. O Estado tem tido um papel muito preponderante na economia portuguesa. O Estado português tem assumido sempre como motor da economia. Aliás, a esmagadora maioria das candidaturas ao PRR é feita por entidades públicas. Eu gostaria de questionar o FMI sobre realmente o que é que faltará aqui para realmente nós conseguirmos alavancar de uma vez por todas o crescimento económico em Portugal. E a minha terceira questão tem a ver com a reforma fiscal em Portugal. O Governo, apoiado quer pelo PSD, quer pelo CDS, quer apostar numa reforma ao nível do IRC, quer reduzir o IRC para tornar as empresas portuguesas mais competitivas. Contudo, tem havido uma resistência por parte do maior partido da oposição relativamente a essa matéria. E aquilo que eu queria questionar era se efetivamente não considerará que a redução do IRC será uma medida fulcral para realmente nós conseguirmos alavancar o crescimento económico em Portugal. Muito obrigado.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Deputado. A palavra agora ao Sr. Deputado Paulo Núncio. Faça o seu deputado.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Presidente. Queria também cumprimentar os senhores e senhores deputados e cumprimentar a delegação, a comitiva do FMI, na pessoa do João-François Dauphin. Eu faço referência à vossa apresentação de hoje, mas também ao relatório que apresentaram no dia 1 de julho deste ano. E gostava de tocar em 3 ou 4 pontos desse relatório que me parecem muito relevantes. O primeiro tem a ver com a necessidade de intervenção para reduzir a pobreza e a desigualdade. Nós sabemos que em Portugal a população em risco de pobreza atinge ainda os 20%, o que é uma percentagem muitíssimo elevada em comparação com outros países europeus. E a primeira pergunta que eu gostava de fazer é como é que o FMI avalia as medidas de combate à pobreza que foram desenvolvidas no passado recente, designadamente no tempo do governo do Partido Socialista. Nós consideramos que a ferramenta mais importante para combater a pobreza é o crescimento económico. Sem um crescimento económico mais robusto, não é possível reduzir a pobreza e reduzir as desigualdades. Mas, para além do crescimento, que medidas é que o FMI propõe para combater mais eficazmente? Parou o tempo. Sr. Presidente, se me der autorização para continuar.
It works on artificial intelligence. Okay.
Por isso, quais são as medidas para combater mais eficazmente a pobreza para além do crescimento económico? A segunda questão tem a ver com as reformas laborais. O FMI insiste e recomenda que para aumentar a produtividade é necessário flexibilizar a lei laboral e eu gostaria de perguntar que medidas é que o FMI recomenda para atingir essa flexibilidade, que é um elemento também decisivo para aumentar a produtividade em Portugal. A terceira questão tem a ver com a reforma fiscal. Propõem a simplificação e a reforma fiscal dos impostos sobre as empresas. É um hot topic neste momento para o Orçamento de Estado de 2025. E propõem a simplificação fiscal e propõem também uma redução do IRC e, na questão específica da redução do IRC, propõem a redução da derrama estadual. De facto, a taxa estatutária em Portugal é a segunda mais alta da União Europeia e, ao contrário do que foi dito anteriormente, a taxa média de IRC em Portugal é a terceira mais alta da União Europeia e, por isso, quer na taxa estatutária, quer na taxa média, nós estamos no topo da Europa. E, por isso, a proposta do FMI é no sentido de aproximar a taxa do IRC em Portugal à taxa média da União Europeia e, fundamentalmente, eliminar ou reduzir gradualmente a derrama estadual, a surcharge que referiram. De facto, esta derrama estadual foi criada em 2010, no tempo do governo do Partido Socialista, do engenheiro José Sócrates. Foi criada como um imposto extraordinário para as empresas, tendo em conta a crise financeira que se avizinhava, que se transformou depois numa situação de bancarrota que levou, aliás, à intervenção externa do FMI. E a pergunta que eu faço é se, na opinião do FMI, este imposto extraordinário às suas empresas, numa situação em que Portugal já tem excedente orçamental, não deveria ser eliminada de imediato. Para além disso, e terminando, Sr. Presidente, para além disso, até beneficiando do facto de não haver outros grupos parlamentares para intervir, este imposto extraordinário, a derrama estadual, contraria, para além de ser extraordinário e já não haver a excepcionalidade do momento para a qual foi criado, contraria a natureza do imposto. O Corporate Income Tax, o imposto sobre as empresas, é por natureza um imposto proporcional, não é um imposto progressivo. Ao incluir este fator de progressividade, este imposto transforma-se num imposto sobre o sucesso, por isso penalizando as empresas que têm mais lucros e penalizando a dimensão e o crescimento das empresas. Nós sabemos, para terminar, nós sabemos que um dos problemas que existe em Portugal é o facto de o tecido empresarial ser constituído em 99% por pequenas e médias empresas. Portugal precisa ter mais grandes empresas. A derrama estadual é precisamente um desincentivo ao crescimento e à dimensão das empresas e gostava de ouvir sobre isso. Muito obrigado.
Muito obrigado, senhores deputados. Dou então a palavra ao senhor Jean-François Dauphin, ou melhor dito, à delegação, para responder às questões que foram colocadas pelos senhores deputados. Faço favor.
Thank you so much, all of you, for your comments and feedback. It's a great discussion. I like it. So you asked a lot of very good questions. Let me try to respond, and I'll try not to forget anything, but feel free to let me know if I do. I think a lot of your questions revolve around how can we get more growth, because if we get more growth, we will help, you know, converge in terms of income levels toward the euro area average, reduce poverty, and reduce debt by the debt to GDP ratio, right? And of course, this is the most important question. So, the way we see it, a lot has to do with increasing investment and increasing productivity. I mean, growth, if you do a very simple growth accounting, is about investment, the capital stock that you're going to have. It's about labor, so how much hours of work are being put into the system, and it's about productivity. You know, how much this capital and this labor that you put together produce per unit of work. So, what what we see when we do the, you know, the math here is that in Portugal, what's really lower than in other countries that grow faster is productivity and investment. So on investment, we do, as I said earlier, agree that there's a need to create space in the budget so that there, one within a given budget envelope, one can spend more on investment. And that's why we have those proposals to look at how efficient is the spending, can you achieve the same outcomes in terms of public service delivery with less money? And, you know, the answer is yes. Actually, the answer is yes almost everywhere, but probably here a little bit more than in some better performing, more efficient administrations. And the other part of making space for more investments is looking at taxation. So making sure that one really reassess the benefits of all the tax exemptions that you have, and making sure that if the plan is to introduce new tax exemptions, they're really worth it. So that's on how to make space for more investments. And I will get back to some of your more specific fiscal questions. Then the other part is productivity. And productivity is complex. There's no magic wand that you know, that there's not one reform that will increase productivity. But productivity is about the skills of the labor force. So it's about continuing. I think Portugal has made tremendous efforts and achieved progress in terms of the outcomes of education. But there's still work to do, in particular in science. When one looks at the, you know, the OECD reports, the famous PISA reports that assesses, it compares across countries the outcome of like 15-year-old kids. Science is still lagging behind in Portugal. So efforts to do there, but it's not only the education system. I mean, it's also the curriculum, making sure that the education system produces skills that are actually needed by companies and reducing mismatches between the skills that are produced and the skills that are needed. And it beyond the school system, it's also the lifelong trainings, right? Making sure you have lifelong a system that allows employees to keep learning and adapting their skills to new changes, like AI, for instance, coming our way big times. How prepared is Portugal to face AI? And how prepared is Portugal in absolute terms, how prepared is Portugal comparing to other countries, right? So upskilling, you know, on productivity, then making sure that resources are allocated in the most efficient way, that resources, there's enough flexibility in the system that capital and labor can go where it's the most productive. And this is where we have the point on labor flexibility. The way we see it, there is a desire in the society to protect as much as possible employees. And that's very understandable, right? The question is the level of protections that we are providing to employees with open-ended contracts, achieving the results that we want. And in our analysis, it's not, because it's become so protective that actually companies would rather hire people on short-term contracts than on open-ended contracts. So the effect is now perverse that companies will refrain from hiring people in open-ended contracts because they need the flexibility to adjust to cycle fluctuations, but also changes in needs and preferences of their customer base, than achieving than hiring in open-ended. So at the end of the day, the employees, the new employees, are less protected, right? Because they get those short-term contracts that are not renewed, so they're less protected. And yet you have an overall system that does not allow the resources to go where they're the most needed. So our recommendation is to look at the open-ended contracts and maybe make hiring and make firing a little bit more flexible so that actually the incentive to hire people directly in open-ended contracts is bigger, right? So that's the point on labor. You asked about, you know, EU funds and the how we can make the best use of them. My colleague Ipe here has done a very interesting study that you will see in the report that's published this afternoon that looks at the impact on productivity of firms that receives EU funds as opposed to firms that don't benefit from EU funds. And the finding is reassuring in the sense that we observe an increase in productivity among the firms that are recipients of EU funds. So there's a beneficial impact on the productivity of firms that receive EU funds. And this is an analysis that IPEI has done based on firm-level data, so really looking at firm-specific data. What have I missed? Balancing debt reduction and growth. Yeah, that's a very hard question. I mean, that's the art of fiscal adjustment, right? What we observe, though, it is possible to reduce debt and not hamper growth. Actually, the more growth you have, the more your debt will go down, and that's exactly what we observed after COVID. So the main reason why debt could go down so fast were higher growth. Inflation, unfortunately, helped. I mean, I say unfortunately because this is not how we want to reduce debt, because inflation is a tax mostly on the poor. But in that case, there was a global inflation shock, and that helped. But that's not the main thing, because if it were, then we would observe the same debt reduction in all countries in the world, because the inflation shock was global. So what was specific in Portugal was really higher growth and fiscal surpluses. Now, on your point on the question on inequalities and poverty, so certainly growth is part of the story, and I talked about that. But I want to show you a graph that I did not explain earlier. And sorry if this is too small. Where is it? Okay, so that chart is super hard to read. But I'm going to try to walk you through it. The right-hand side chart looks at how the how much fiscal policy overall contributes to redistributing the wealth, the income, the value added generated by the economy. So in other words, how much fiscal policy contributes to reducing inequalities. It's looking at it from not only overall but by instrument, right? So the blue, so each bar is a country, and the bar that is like lighter is Portugal. I don't know if you can really see. And each color in the bar represents a different fiscal instrument. So blue is pension. Red is non-mean tested transfers, so transfers that go to everybody irrespective of income. green is mean-tested transfers, so transfers that are made based on the income of the recipient. Yellow is direct taxation, so it's the redistribution by the progressive personal income tax. The little gray is social contributions, right? The whole point of this graph, and I don't think it's actually readable on the screen, so I apologize for that, but we'll share it, is that in Portugal, the role of mean-tested instrument is smaller than in other countries. So what that tells you is that there is it's lower, it's smaller. There is an opportunity in Portugal to maybe use more mean-tested social transfer as an instrument to help reduce inequalities and reduce poverty. So just food for thought, right? So, something you can think about and see where the opportunities are. Let me see what I... You asked, you know, what would happen if there's no budget. I don't know. I know that you have an institutional framework that provides for continuity of functioning of the states, and that's great. The broader point I was making is that, you know, it's something I could say anywhere. It's not Portugal specific. If a government has a majority, the government has more leeway to implement the reforms that are needed or the fiscal policy that is needed. If the government is in a minority, it's going to be more difficult, it's going to take more time. And that's the situation we're in here at this stage. And I could also say anywhere, the more uncertainty you have, whether it's uncertainty about the direction of economic policies, or global uncertainties, you know, really what might happen in the world, investment goes down. That's just an empirical fact. So that was the only point I was making. You asked about the income tax for the young. Portugal is not the only country I'm aware of that has introduced such measures. I'm aware of other countries. And I think our view is everywhere we see them, we're not really in favor of them because that raises a number of issues. First of all, it's costly. So, So first of all, it's a lost income. So one needs to really make sure that, you know, we have the cost. Are we going to get the benefits we want? And frankly, that's the part where we have a big question mark. It is absolutely not certain that this measure in itself will actually serve the purpose it intends to serve. In addition, it poses some equity or threshold issues, right? It's easy to think, and I'm sorry if this is a bit of a caricature, but imagine you have a super successful young YouTuber, you know, a 25-year-old YouTuber who's going to make millions of euros on YouTube, and a 36-year-old factory worker who's going to make a lower income. Is it really what we want that the 25-year-old YouTuber would pay an income tax rate that is lower than the 36 factory workers? And again, it's a bit of a caricatural point, but this is just to illustrate the issues. So that's why we're not really in favor of that. We do think that, you know, it's more helpful to target the support to really based on income level. So, if for instance, you know, we talked about housing affordability. If housing affordability is an issue, and it is an issue in Portugal, is it better to help one category of the population because of their age or the population because of their income, right? Help the the lower income access more, housing that are relevant. One last point, I think it's the last one on the IRC, so the corporate income tax. We do have also the graph here, right? So you're right. The statutory rate. So this is the right hand chart, if you cannot read, right? And this is the tax revenue in percent of GDP, comparing across euro area countries. The red bar is Portugal. The line is the average of the euro area. So the on paper, the statutory rates tend to be higher than the rest of the euro area. But at the end of the day, what is being collected is on the average. So that means that there are a lot of, as you guys described, a lot of exceptions, different tax rates, surcharges, some by the size of the economies or the profitability of the economies, some are actually local, so by depending on the regions you're in. It's a fairly complex system, but certainly one point where we do think that it's not helpful is, as some of you put it, like trying to have a progressive taxation for companies, right? Because that to us is really creating an incentive not to grow. And that's not what we want. We want companies to grow, because companies that grow are companies that create jobs and create wealth, and that wealth is the wealth of the population at the end, right? So those surcharges or those that progressivity in corporate income tax is really not helpful the way we see it. I think I answered all questions. If I didn't, let me know. I may have been.
Well, it took us the hour we had planned, in the half of the budget committee, we'd like to thank you for your presentation. I'll pick up your availability to ask if you can spare us a copy of that presentation for us. Yes. We'll only distribute it after 2 p.m. Yeah,
yeah.
Your concern, sir.
I think the one we're showing comes from a flash drive that we.
Oh, okay.
So you could just copy it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Okay, yeah. Thank you. Senhoras e senhores, vamos só interromper por um breve instante, só para poder acompanhar a delegação e, portanto, prosseguiremos a nossa reunião. Faça.
Thank you very much for hosting us, and thank you for your comments and feedbacks and questions.